about political history with the end of the Peloponnesian War and the defeat of Athens by Sparta. And you recall that Sparta had established itself in control of Athens with a garrison on the Acropolis and had established an oligarchy. And the Athenian democrats were either killed off or driven into exile. Now, this same thing happened to all of Athens' allies. Other city-states, islands that had been allied with Athens, also had Spartan garrisons and governors put in charge, and the oligarchical parties were put in control. Now, this worked all right for a while, but all of these people were restive, and finally, the Athenian democrats banded together and drove the Spartans out, and either killed off the heads of the oligarchic party or drove them into exile, and Athens again became a democracy. Now, this established a pattern, and a good many of these other states under Spartan control began also to rebel against Spartan governorship and the oligarchic parties, and they began to ask Athens for support against Spartan. Beyond that, some of the Spartan governors began to decide that life outside Sparta was better than life inside it, and they liked where they were, where the food was better, the hell with black broth, and so on. And so they began to try to set themselves up independently. The result of all this was that Sparta called the governors back and retired into itself again, paying no attention to the rest of Greece. And Athens now again became the leading main power in the Greek peninsula. Persia, which had formerly supported the Spartans with money, now supported the Athenians with money. And Athens sailed on to establish something of a second empire. But this, like the Spartan one, was to be relatively short-lived, because a city-state to the west of Athens named Thebes developed an extraordinary new kind of military machine, a new kind of infantry, and used it in advanced forms, and they now tended to take over and defeat other Greek states, and they in their turn became the leading power in the Greek peninsula and were again supported by Persian money in this. In other words, what you get is a constant series of wars and changes of power going on. The other thing that occurs in this period is that there is an increasingly large group of exiles floating around in Greece outside of their own city-state, and these begin to be used and hired to be mercenary soldiers for other states and powers. Now, this is the basic situation when Macedon appears on the scene. Macedonia was a state just north of the main Greek states. And it was a state which for a long time had been viewed by the Greeks as being perhaps cousins, but not really truly Greek. The Macedonians had a king and almost a kind of feudal nobility. Kings had not been terribly powerful until about this time, when they began to consolidate the Macedonians and become a stronger state. The Macedonians believed in polygamy. Kings had several wives. They also had a tendency to be drunks and to drink wine without its being cut with water. And culturally, there are other slight differences between them. Now, the king of Macedonia, as a boy, had been captured by the Thebans, and he had been held in the city of Thebes as a hostage. This is Philip of Macedon. When he was finally released and went back to rule Macedonia, he understood precisely and exactly how the Theban war machine operated. And he went back to Macedonia and rather quickly managed to subdue the outstanding Macedonian chieftains and to consolidate a large and a strong state. Now, Macedon was also accustomed to using cavalry in war very effectively, and he remodeled his infantry on the Theban fashion, supported it with Macedonian cavalry, and now Philip of Macedon went to the attack against Greece. In the famous battle of Chaeronea, he totally defeated the Thebans. The key part of the Theban army was the so-called Sacred Band, and those were slaughtered to a man in that battle. Indeed, the whole city was destroyed except for one house. That was where the poet Pindar had been born a century earlier, and Philip of Macedon thought so highly of him as a poet that he spared that one house. So Thebes was destroyed, and Philip managed then to subdue and force the Athenians into alliance with him. He did not destroy Athens, and went on to conquer most of Greece. Now, what Philip tried to do then was to form a so-called Hellenic League, a league of all the different Greek city-states in the peninsula, which would be under the guidance of Macedonia. Philip would be president of the league, and what this would do would be to support Philip with its manpower in further wars. Now, Philip intended, in fact, to use this new war machine he was creating in an attack against Persia. He went back to Macedon, and there he finally went to attend the wedding of a friend of his, and as he was leaving the wedding ceremonies, he was assassinated. Now, no one knows who assassinated Philip of Macedon, whether it was a Greek, or whether it was a spy sent by the Persians, or whether it was someone hired by one of his wives, because he had been married to a princess from Epirus, a state over on the west coast, a rather savage state, and then he had taken a young wife, and she had retired in a deep huff back to Epirus at this point, but she had borne Philip a son, and she was determined that her son would indeed inherit Macedonia. So it may well be that he was assassinated by someone hired by his wife Olympias. At any rate, he vanished from the scene just as he was preparing for the attack on Persia. Now, the person who inherited the throne was the Epirot princess's son, Alexander. And this is, of course, the appearance on the scene of Alexander the Great. Alexander becomes king at the age of 18. He was extraordinarily well educated. Indeed, his tutor had been the philosopher Aristotle. And he had already participated in battles. He had been in the famous Battle of Chaeronea against the Thebans. So that he is a seasoned warrior at the age of 18. Now, Alexander is all the other proper things also. He is beautiful, he is charismatic, and his breath smells of violence. That's from an original source, by God. That's the best I can say for that. But certainly he is a person who has an enormous amount of charisma. Now, Alexander is immediately forced, in fact, to put down resurgent nobles in Macedonia and to establish his control of that. Then he is forced to go down and reestablish control of Greece and to reestablish his father's Hellenic League. Only then is he prepared to take up the venture his father had wanted, the attack on Persia. And of course, this means that Alexander, when he is somewhere roughly around your age, is prepared to take on the greatest power of the ancient world. So much for what you kids are accomplishing. He gathers together this large army of Greeks. He crosses over the Hellespont into Asia Minor. Now, not very deep into Asia Minor, he fights the first great battle. And this is against the Persian satrap of Asia Minor, And Alexander indeed is in the forefront of battle, leading the cavalry charge against the small stream, the Granicus. And he is, in fact, almost killed. He is so impetuous. He's saved by one of the older friends of his father, a man named Clytus, and the Greeks are totally victorious. Now, the Persian army is defeated, and Alexander marches down the coast of Asia Minor, again freeing those Greek cities. Now, as Alexander continues to move down there, his army also grows larger, because now it takes in contingents from all of that Greek area, and he finally then marches across the southern coast of Asia Minor. He gets inland as far as Gordium, where the other... Well, there are all kinds of legends that are nice with Alexander. Alexander sees himself as a second Achilles. And as Achilles had a friend, Patroclus, Alexander has a friend, Hephaestion. And when they come to the site of Troy, Alexander goes into the temple there and exchanges his shield for what is by tradition supposed to be the shield of Achilles that hangs there. And then he runs three times naked round the walls of ancient Troy with his friend, and they dedicate themselves to this struggle. When he comes to Gordium, there is a very famous knot in the temple that no one can untie. And by tradition, whoever unties it can conquer the world. Alexander resolves it very easily. He simply takes a very sharp sword and goes whack, and that's the end of the knot. And he then leads his armies across the southern part. And in the meantime, of course, the great king of kings, this is again a Darius in Persia, gathers his enormous army to stop Alexander. They meet in the second of the famous battles, in what would today be northern Syria. And this is a terrible battle. Indeed, there are elephants, and the Persians have chariots with long knives on the wheels, scythed chariots, and so on. It's a bloody battle. It's a battle which is fought all day long, with very considerable loss on both sides. But just as the day is waning, Darius finally freaks out and gets in his chariot and simply leaves the field of battle. His army follows him, and Alexander is again the victor after this long battle. Now, one of the results from this is that Darius sends messengers to Alexander and suggests that he is now willing to give all of Asia Minor to Alexander to be his own territory, which would be an enormous and a very wealthy conquest. And the response of Alexander to this is very short and to the point. There cannot be two suns in the same sky, which means that he will continue the war. Now, Alexander does not turn against Persia at this point. Instead, he starts down the coast of Syria and Palestine, where he lays siege to Tyre and to the cities there. He finally marches down and takes over all of Egypt. So he has now conquered Syria, Palestine, and Egypt itself. In Egypt, he founds a city on the seacoast with a good harbor, and it is, of course, going to become the city of Alexander. He himself goes on an extraordinary venture with a few friends out across the desert to an oasis which had a famous oracle of Jupiter Ammon. And what happens there, no one is quite sure. But when Alexander comes out of his personal conversation with the god in the temple, he announces that he has indeed been accepted as a god himself, and thereafter he takes over the old position of Egyptian pharaohs of being a living god. And he wears the ram's horns as signs of this from that time on. Only now does Alexander begin to turn back to meet the Persian army. Now he is again swelling his army with recruits from Egypt, from Syria, all of these various places, and they meet in the third of the great battles now. the one called Arbela. And here again, there is a long and terrible battle between these now massive forces. And again, the Persian king of kings retreats from the battlefield and flees for safety into the heart of Persia itself. Alexander, left victorious, moves down to capture Babylon with its great treasure. He captures Susa. He goes to Persepolis, the treasure city of the Persians, and takes that enormous mass of gold that is there. He also burns the palace in Persepolis. How or why, we don't know. Whether it was an accidental fire or an intentional one, there are half a dozen various reasons given by contemporaries for it. He goes to Ecbatana, the fourth of the capitals, and seizes it. This gives him simply enough money to pay all the back pay of his entire army. And at the same time, he is busy bringing into the army and establishing in positions of governorship and control Persians and Medes, as well as all the others. He now goes after Darius, and he, whom he learns has fled up toward what we would call Turkestan, and pursuing Darius with his armies, he finds eventually the body of the dead Darius left by the roadside. Darius has been murdered by his own followers and left behind. Alexander swears vengeance against the murderers of Darius and proceeds to pursue them up into the area that is today, roughly Afghanistan and Turkestan, that section. Now, Alexander is to spend some time up there because here, for the first time, he begins to have troubles. He runs into guerrilla warfare rather than a massed army, which can be defeated. So that he tends to march round and round in that area, defeating towns, groups of people, and so on. He found several cities called Alexandria up in that territory also. And, of course, he leaves Greeks behind as governors. They will, in time, establish a Greek state in what is today Afghanistan, the kingdom of Bactria. And Alexander himself, with his army, now sets out down into India proper, going down along the Indus River Valley. And here again are some famous battles. He is himself very, very severely wounded in one of them, but he manages indeed to win all of these battles. And then comes his first real setback, because Alexander thinks that he is in fact at this point very close to the Eastern Ocean. In other words, that he is near the end of the world on that side. And Alexander wants to go on and conquer right straight across India to the ocean. And at this point, the troops simply sit down and say, uh-uh. You know, it's been a long walk here from Greece. Our feet hurt. And they simply do not want to go any further at all. They've never heard of anything like this. They haven't seen anything they've ever heard of for a very long time, in fact, now. And they won't go on. And Alexander is forced to turn back. Now, he splits his troops up. Part of his army goes back by sea, simply going down the Indus River and then across the Persian Gulf and up to Euphrates that way, back to Babylon. He and the other troops set out to march back across southern Persia. Now, this is one of the deadliest deserts in existence, even to this day. And Alexander has no idea what he's getting into. Enormous numbers die off as he marches across those waterless wastes. The whole army is next to extinction when they finally do get back to civilization. He has been given up as dead even before this, but he does come back. He goes back to Babylon to take over and now to control this enormous empire that he has established. One thing that he wants to do, and that he has done constantly, is to create a kind of cultural and political combination of all of these various persons. He has taken the Persians and so on into his employ, and they have high positions under him. He also has taken over a position much more like the Persian King of Kings, even in regard to his old Greek friends. In addition to this, he now decides that he wants them to intermarry. And so he stages a famous mass marriage ceremony in which he himself takes a Persian princess as wife. His best friend, Hephaestion, marries a sister of the princess he marries. And some 2,000 Greek soldiers marry 2,000 Persian women. It's the famous mass marriage. What he is clearly planning on here, in other words, is a very genuine amalgamation of these people, that one is not to be superior to the other, even the Greeks are not to be held as superior to the Persians, but that you will have the best of all groups brought out together in this new world. It is an extraordinary concept, and Alexander, indeed, is thinking of such things as a circumnavigation of the peninsula of Arabia. But just at this crucial time, his closest friend Hephaestion dies of fever. Alexander really freaks with this. He is deeply stricken with grief. And Alexander's already shown some tendency, like his father, to go on massive drunks. And then have terrible, terrible hangovers with this. The death of Hephaestion leads him into this. He goes back in midsummer to Babylon, fever-ridden country, to celebrate the great funeral games for Hephaestion. And there he comes down with fever. And this is the fever which will kill Alexander the Great at the age of 33 years old. He has conquered that enormous empire with all of these vast dreams of going on. Now, this is one of the reasons, in case you didn't know it, why 33 is the perfect year. It's all downhill after you reach 33, and I can attest to that personally. 33 is the age at which Alexander the Great dies, the age at which Christ is crucified. Hence, 33 is the perfect year. The death of Alexander is itself extraordinary. Alexander is dying in the great palace in Babylon, and the news reaches the Greek troops that Alexander is on his deathbed, and they break down the doors of the palace, and that entire Greek army marches past the deathbed of the dying Alexander when he is so ill he can hardly move a finger to greet them, to say a final farewell to this extraordinary leader. And the next day, indeed, Alexander is dead. Now, he leaves behind him a wife who is pregnant, but who has not yet produced a child. So there is no immediate heir to Alexander the Great. And, of course, what happens is that the leading general sees this opportunity to try to carve up that extraordinary domain. His wife, Roxana, produces a son, and the son is never allowed to grow up. Roxana and the child are all both killed off. And the empire of Alexander is split up. Now, what would have happened had Alexander lived to be 53 is, of course, one of the most gorgeous ifs in history. You have with Alexander one of those extraordinary times in history where the sheer personality of one man seems to change the course of history. There aren't very many of these. But a normal person would have stopped and been willing to just have Asia Minor to rule, for instance, not insisted on everything. A normal man could certainly never have got the army to go along with him through that extraordinary event, or conceived of the amalgamation of peoples. Alexander is incredibly charismatic and well worth reading about, because he's fascinating, even if his breath does smell fire. Instead of mint. What happens then, he dies in 323, B.C., is that for almost the next quarter of a century, you have a long series of wars in which that empire is being broken up and various parts are established. Now, what it breaks up into are basically these parts. A general named Ptolemy, which is spelled with a P-T, but who is pure Greek, takes over Egypt and some outlying sections, the island of Cyprus, and at various times other bits and pieces. But Egypt is his essential territory. He also was smart enough to carry off the body of Alexander the Great, and Alexander was buried in an extraordinary mausoleum in the very center of Alexandria, of which no trace, of course, has ever been found. So this begins the Ptolemaic Empire. A second general named Seleucus takes over what is basically the Asian part of it. That is Syria, parts of Palestine, all of Mesopotamia, Persia, and the Indian provinces. So those will be lost fairly quickly. This is the Seleucid Empire. A third empire takes over the old territory of Macedonia and Thrace, with sometimes a certain kind of control over Greece. This is the Antigonid Empire. Now, the fourth section is Asia Minor, and Asia Minor is divided up into several independent states, Bithynia, Pergamum, and so on. As the whole Greece becomes simply a territory where you go to raise soldiers, and all of the three main empires will use this as a source of manpower for their armies. So the age of city-states is now replaced, and this is now called the Hellenistic Age, as opposed to the Hellenic Age, becomes an age of large empires and of huge cities, because Alexandria becomes a city of over a million. Antioch, the new foundation of the Seleucids, becomes a city of over a million, as opposed to the little Greek cities of 100,000. Now you have the big city syndrome coming in, and a whole new look to the world. These then are the powers of the Eastern Mediterranean, and they will remain the major powers for some time. In general, along with this goes a kind of change of feeling. This is always considered the age of Greek decadence. Several things happen. One is that you have a division into the very rich and the very poor that comes up with the big cities in particular. And along with this goes a certain loss of real belief in the old gods. And instead, people began to do more and more talking about the bitch goddess luck or fortune, and to say that you have to seize your fortune when you get it, and you never know when you'll be up and when you'll lose everything, that everything is due to luck, not to a man's own endeavors, but just to luck. This is a kind of loss of faith then in themselves as individuals. And there are a series of new philosophies that come up along with this. One of them is cynicism, started by Diogenes. Now, Diogenes simply believed that basically everything was lousy and all people were lousy. And the only way that you could possibly get by in such a lousy, dreadful world was just to abandon everything, to just cut life down to the bare minimum. So he lives in a barrel and he has a cup to drink water out of, and that's it, kids. That's all. And indeed, one day he sees a little Greek boy go down to the stream and dip up water in his two hands. And so Diogenes throws the cup away. Don't need that either. The hell with that. But he feels free to criticize everybody. Indeed, there's a famous meeting on one occasion between himself and Alexander the Great. Alexander comes to see this odd man and stands there, and Diogenes looks up at him, and all he snarls is, "You're throwing your shadow on me. Get out of my sunlight." That's the cynical approach, in fact, is to snarl at everybody and not have anything. Nobody can take it away from you if you don't have anything. So, you know, screw off. It's a sullen point of view. But it certainly is a shift from Plato and Aristotle. Okay. The second major philosophy that comes through is Epicureanism, founded by Epicurus. And he takes over the old concept of the atomic theory of the earth. But what Epicurus preaches is that this is indeed a troublesome world and a veil of tears. And that what you need in order to get by is to cultivate a kind of golden mean, nothing too much. And in particular, it's notable that he believes that you should, for instance, always eat enough so that you are not hungry, because being hungry is painful. Starving to death is not nice. On the other hand, if you eat too much, you get a bellyache. So that's bad also. What you want to do is to eat rationally, just as much as you need, and no more. A simple diet. God, that would be popular today. Back to the alfalfa. One more time. He's sort of the original health food store man. He also believes, for instance, that love will not do, because love can bring much too much grief and anguish and pain. And if you haven't found that out already, you will. On the other hand, a total lack of any human relationship is equally painful. Loneliness is not good. So what you should cultivate are nice, cool friendships. Then if you lose it, well, it's not so exquisitely agonizing. There are more of these. He believes that, indeed, you should not participate in the events of this world. The ideal position for the Epicurean philosopher, and he describes it, is to sit up on a hilltop, and down below, warring armies of various persons make their wars below you, and you look down and say, God, this is stupid. But you do not participate, you do not get involved in anything. You cultivate a detached golden mean, and by so doing, you save yourself from the anguish that is this world is made up of. Now that's the Epicurean. The other one are the Stoics. Now the Stoics took a somewhat similar bent. You must realize that all of these philosophies are no longer dealing with ideal forms or how the universe operates. They have one single point of view. How do you get by as a person in this god-awful world? How do you survive? And this is the whole pitch of Hellenistic philosophy. Now, the Stoics believe that, unlike the Epicureans, you could, in fact, amass wealth, you could hold public office, you could participate in the world. But you must not allow any of this to have any importance to you whatsoever. So that, in fact, if you lose it, it is not going to matter. What you cultivate is a frame of mind. But you are allowed to participate in world events or allowed to amass wealth. And indeed, it follows along the theory and it develops the theory that all men are exactly the same. That while they may have different fortunes, all men can, at least, work up this philosophy of not allowing the blows of fate to matter to them. Indeed, a much later follower of this is to write that there is no real difference between an emperor or a slave, that they are all subject to the whims of fate, and they must all work out a Stoic philosophy. It is, I think, worth noting that that particular thing is written by an emperor, not by a slave. Just the same, this is the general Stoic point of view. Now, the Stoic point of view is going to be the most popular of these three philosophies. It will be the one which will be influential primarily in Rome, simply, of course, because it does allow to participate in things of this world. On the other hand, it does not encourage you to be particularly charitable or to interfere in the lives of others, because, in fact, the only real good you can do to anyone else is to teach him not to let anything matter to him or to her. So that if someone is starving, well, they've just got to learn to starve, that's all, and not let it matter. You don't have to feed them. It is not basically the most charitable or charitably oriented of all philosophies. But the thing I really want to point out to you most is how philosophy has now geared down to how should an individual deal with himself in order to survive in such a chancy world. This is what Hellenistic philosophy gets. Now, the Hellenistic age is notable for all kinds of other things. It is notable for the creation of some large businesses and business monopolies in such things as glass making, paper making, things of this nature. It is an age which indeed begins to put together enormous libraries. The very famous library at Alexandria, the library at Pergamum with thousands of volumes, and the libraries, in fact, of these places turn into something rather like a graduate school, where you have resident scholars who read the text and do commentaries on the text. And our version of Homer, for instance, is created with commentaries in the Hellenistic period. In other words, the footnote is invented in the Hellenistic period. It is also an astonishing age of science. It is an age in which there are all kinds of inventions of things like levers and pulleys. Archimedes is the great scientist who invents a new system for raising water to a higher level, the Archimedean screw. And indeed, Archimedes says that if you'll give him some place to stand, that with his knowledge of levers, he can move the earth. So that you have an enormous amount of this. Someone in the age actually understands steam power. But the trouble is they don't know how to harness it or what to do with it. It is used to make table talk. But the principle of steam power is recognized. At the same time, this is when Euclid is writing the textbooks on simple geometry and so on. It is an age in which you have a town planning as a major element, and ideal town plans are laid out. It is an age in which you have a good deal of new humanitarian legislation to improve the lot of slaves, legislation that sets up ways in which slaves can leave cruel masters and so on. There is better legislation for women to control their own property, dowries, things of this nature. You have a whole series of moves in these directions. Now, all of this ought to have some kind of familiar overtone to you. Most of these things are things that have been going on in the 19th and 20th century all over again. The age of footnotes, the age of science, the age of humanitarian legislation, the age of big cities, planned cities, urban planning, all the rest of this, of large libraries, increased education, all of this is what marks the Hellenistic age in very, very many ways. It is also the age in which you have an enormous amount of history being written and studied. Most of that is today lost. But we know, for instance, of a whole long series of books, of biographies, for instance, of Alexander the Great that are lost. Ptolemy himself wrote a biography. The man who led the fleet back from India wrote an account of that. All of this kind of work was going on in this Hellenistic age. It was, in this sense, an extraordinary period. It was a period of power struggles to a very major degree, and we'll get into the power struggles between East and West very shortly after this. But nonetheless, it was an age that saw enormous kinds of progress in certain respects. It is an age in which the novel becomes a form of literature, and you have some early Greek novels, The Golden Ass of Apuleius, and so on. It is also an age of a particular kind of new poetry, the idyll. This is a period in which people began to write poems about how marvelous it would be to move out to the country, where life is simple and sweet. Oh, to be a simple shepherd boy, to just simply eat simple things, have simple loves, be out in nature, join a commune. It is precisely this. Now, this is a kind of theme that only comes up when you have lots of people living in big cities. Only big city people, in fact, write about the joys of the farm and the countryside. Farmers never do. They have never been known to write about the joys of that. But big city people do this, so that all of these ideas begin to come out, this megalopolitan age, and stir up in this way. It establishes a much more sophisticated set of patterns, but at the same time, far more individualistic. The concept of the polis and of the group to which you owe loyalty, in a deep sense, more loyalty to the group than to yourself, has simply ceased to exist. That whole early Greek concept has died. It has been replaced by a concept of everybody out for themselves and devil take the hindmost kid, because I'd as soon kick you if I have to get out first as not. I mean, it's real simple. It gets down to jungle laws of survival to a degree that are going on here. And which reach this kind of thing. You have riots occurring in cities in this period, things of this nature that show up. It is, in other words, a whole new kind of world that has appeared on the scene. It's a world of extraordinary wealth and extraordinary splendor in many respects, but a world in which there are also enormous numbers of genuine poverty-stricken peoples as well. It is a whole new look that comes to things. And I want you to realize this change that takes place, and also the fact that this is always referred to as the age of decadence of Greece. That, in fact, the age of the libraries, the age of science, the age of the footnote, the age of humanitarianism, these are all considered to be signs of the deepest decadence. In Greece. And that might just raise the question in you, of where the hell are you? And on that happy thought, I will leave.